You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Holly.
Hello, Bob.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good, all things considered.
I know that feeling. Let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. And you are Holly Elmore, executive director of Pause AI US. This is your second appearance with us. You were here a few months ago talking about artificial intelligence. As the name of your organization suggests, you are of the view that this AI thing is moving along a little too fast, and we could stand to slow down and proceed with more caution. And in fact, things have moved fast enough that there's new stuff to talk about since you were last on. And I almost don't know where to start. Now, one thing I'm very interested in is you had said you'd be willing to give kind of thumbnail evaluations of the big five AI potentates in the U.S. That's Sam Altman of OpenAI, Demis Hassabis of Google DeepMind, Dario Amodei of Anthropic, the inimitable Elon Musk of xAI, and I guess Mark Zuckerberg deserves to be in there because even though he doesn't currently have a highly regarded frontier model, he just spent enough money to buy up about half of the AI talent in the Western Hemisphere and promises big things. So I'm looking forward to that. But first, why don't we catch up on stuff? One thing I want to talk about is this Wall Street Journal headline I saw a couple days ago: OpenAI executives rattled by campaigns to derail for-profit restructuring. Because I know you were one of a number of organizations that signed a letter that I think, hoping to rattle people at OpenAI about that. But before we get into that, is there what else you want to say about the last few months? I mean, you know, GPT-5 came out and some people reevaluated their timelines, which is to say how long they think it'll be before we get to this thing called artificial general intelligence and so on. And I don't know what else has happened that's of concern to somebody like you on the safety front. So you can just start wherever you want.
Well, every day is like 20 years in terms of news in this world. So, I mean, it's almost hard mentally to return to 2 months ago, you know?
Yeah,
So on the release of GPT-5, there has been like a big cultural change around that. So it's, for now, there's this perception that like people like Gary Marcus and people who like broadly like a sort of like left liberal faction that has maintained that this is all hype. There's a sense that like they are winning now because GPT-5 was not as big of a step as like GPT-3 to GPT-4. I think that whole frame is very mistaken. First of all, I'm very pleased that GPT-5 isn't as big of a step, you know, as GPT-3 to GPT-4. I think this is great. I am really happy for anything that like naturally gives us more time to develop, to prepare for, you know, more advanced AI development is great. I think it would also be great if it were true, which we don't know yet, you know, that there is like a real data wall or data, you know, a real wall in development in terms of needing more fresh data. And also maybe if there was a wall in terms of compute that was somehow hit, any kind of natural obstacle to the scaling process for this kind of AI working to develop bigger and bigger, more powerful AI is good in my opinion. But unfortunately it gives people the idea that there's sort of like a wrong paradigm, which I think is very harmful, which is this idea that if the AI is powerful and dangerous, that's somehow like a win for the AI companies. And so to acknowledge that it's powerful and dangerous is like giving them a win, being part of their narrative, rather than, you know, Pause AI is against what they're doing. And it's because this technology could be powerful and dangerous. We don't think that makes them good. We don't think that makes them like mighty. We think that the right is still with the people to say no to developing dangerous technology like this, not knowing what you're doing. And I get the sense from a lot of people, I have a lot of conversations, you know, about this. I get the sense from a lot of people that they feel like they are fighting against the AI companies and like corporate greed and irresponsibility by saying it's all hype. And it just, those are just two different things. even if this paradigm of, you know, scaling machine learning transformers turns out to be like run its course, there are going to be other ways to develop, you know, artificial intelligence. And what we need to be focused on and what Pause AI is focused on is having society assert itself on like, what do we want with artificial intelligence when it comes? That's what the pause is for, is to figure these out, these questions about how we're going to deal with governing dangerous AI. And it's not just about one paradigm or one company. So I think it's really great that we seem to have a little bit of a reprieve, like we're going to get some extra time before we have even greater capabilities that are more disruptive with AI, based on if the release of GPT-5, you know, and where it is any indication. Some people also argue, and I think pretty convincingly, that it is pretty much on the same, you know, trend line as the previous releases, and that maybe it's just that this jump in capabilities is not as, you know, impressive on a gut level as the jump from 2 to 3 or 3 to 4. I think that's also very possible, that honestly, this is not anything different than the trend line we were seeing. Maybe because it's not an acceleration of the trend line that we were seeing, people are feeling kind of complacent. So there's also that possibility that it's not really representing any kind of departure. I think it would be good if it did represent a slowdown. I think the idea that AI slowing down like kind of shows that the CEOs are just all like full of hot air and we don't have to worry about them is pretty bad. I think like the message we should be taking away is, yay, we have time to prevent these CEOs who are full of hot air, but also have, you know, access to real, you know, technology that is going to, that could potentially become even more destructive and powerful. Already, we don't really know what to do with the implications of the technology that, that they've developed. I think the real takeaway should be like, great, we have more time to put guardrails in place, which we still need.
On this, you said that some people actually think there isn't any real slowdown that's manifest in GPT-5. On this one metric that got so much attention starting, I don't know, a little less than a year ago, I think, from this group called Meter, M-E-T-R, which is like looking at how long it would take a human to do tasks that the AI can do. So the metric is, you know, human labor time or whatever. And what got everybody's attention was that the time seemed to be doubling every 7 months over several years. In other words, every, you know, when there's a new AI comes out and you compare how long it would take a human to do the things it can do in certain realms like coding and other realms, that every 7 months, you know, you had a doubling. And obviously that's exponential. I mean, that really catches up with you fast. I gather that, first of all, the doubling time is now thought to be shorter than 7 months, at least according to the last few models. And secondly, I think GPT-5 is on that curve, right? It's not, I don't think it lags behind on that, does it?
You know, I don't recall where it falls on Meter. I'm thinking of Peter Wildeford's post about this in a number of ways. He showed that it seemed to be like in the cone, you know, around different. Meter's one way of looking at, and the reason that Meter is considered by experts, at least in AI safety, to be that measure is considered good, is that that's considered like one of the best proxies we have of agency and like long-term planning.
Right.
So it's about how long it takes AIs to do tasks that humans do. So like how long it takes a human to do it, and then like how long it takes an AI to do it. That is thought to be like the one of the better measures that we have of AIs using long-term planning or being able to like have a goal and carry it out over many steps over a long time, which is an area where they're weak. Like if you, you know, play with LLMs, like you can see that. Like they can give you like excellent, you know, when you give them like one discrete thing to do, they can exceed human performance in a bunch of ways. But if you kind of tell them to like break down the task, like that's where it gets harder. And like that's something that, I mean, it just mechanistically makes sense that this would be like take longer to train. It would take more specific situations that we don't have. It takes more kinds of data, which they're developing, you know, in order to train this ability. But yeah, even like certain, there were a couple of other measures where like GPT-5 actually like it was underplayed in their early like pre-release evals, like how much catastrophic bio risk it presented. And in the evaluations done on the model after it was released, you know, like by I believe by different outside groups, showed a lot more. If you kind of these evaluations involve a lot of finesse, like you can elicit a lot more capabilities from the models, like if you kind of learn how to do that, you know. And and it's really hard to know, like, are you representing an average user? Are you representing like what kind of outliers are there?
And here the question is, how much would it help you make a bioweapon? Is that
present any kind of bio risk, like order, you know, a dangerous sequence, order a dangerous poison, order, you know, like grow a dangerous bacteria. Like those are the kinds of there's a virology bench set, you know, for like competence to use virology equipment, like, and knowing what, how to grow what and what would present a danger. So that danger was seemed to be underestimated about GPT-5. And actually, you know, the I think, again, this is from Peter Waldeford, the graph that I saw on that seemed to show like a jump, you know, from like there's kind of a smooth increase and then there's a jump in GPT-5's capabilities. So that was even a discontinuity. That was, it presented a lot more danger than we even thought. OpenAI admitted that it was going to increase the level of danger of the models that they had out there before the release. But in fact, they even kind of used it to hype. So I don't think those people are wrong, by the way, who think that AI companies are using danger to make their product seem more cool and attract investment and make it seem more powerful. I think that is true. I just think that they're also not completely full of shit and that it really, that there is the potential for their product to cause danger.
And I mean, also, I've noticed, I think, some scaling back of their level of alarm, at least in the sense that they always say, well, the real risks are another generation away. And then you get to that generation, they say, well, the real risk is, I mean... you know, I even Dario Amodei, who I think is thought of as one of the more sincere on the risk front, he's CEO of Anthropic. You know, on the bio risk, I mean, Anthropic, a little, I think, less than a year ago, for the first time themselves gave themselves a particular kind of bio risk like level. They reached some new level by their own accounting.
Yeah.
But I heard him on a podcast kind of minimize, kind of saying, well, look, it's another threat vector. The world is full of threat vectors. We deal with threat vectors, you know. And similarly, well, this is a little different, but I just saw a chart today from a guy you probably know named Harlan Stewart. It was about things Sam Altman has said over the years. And he's quit saying the hardcore doom things that he said back when OpenAI was just getting started, and
as recently as 2023. Yeah, that was still his message.
Yeah, I think actually maybe I can find the chart. Yeah, so he had said in 2023, he said, I think if this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong. The bad case, and I think this is like important to say, is lights out for all of us. Yeah that sounds pretty bad. But now more recently, he said, and I guess this is in context, I mean, he says, if something goes wrong, it's that we build legitimate superintelligence and it doesn't make the world much better. Well, that's different from lights out, right? I mean,
yes.
So he seems to have toned down the threat level a little. So why don't we, as long as we're talking about these people, I am curious as to your take. I mean, we have five pretty different personalities, it seems to me. And I guess Mark Zuckerberg is the only one who is not known to at least have gone through a phase where he was talking in a seemingly sincere way about risk, right? I mean, I'm not aware. I mean, he came in through kind of the back door, right? Whereas somebody like Demis Hassabis was in on AI at kind of the ground level. I mean, he's been in this game a long time. He's an actual AI guy. And Sam Altman is not an AI guy. He's a founder. He's been into the literature and talking about this for a long time. I mean, he helped organize OpenAI. And of course, Dario Amodei left OpenAI out of disenchantment with Altman's, in his view, I think, lack of commitment to safety and founded Anthropic. And then, you know, Elon Musk has intermittently sounds pretty doomerish. Sometimes he sounds more disappointed about it than other times. But anyway, well, do you want to, how do these people look from your point of view? Are there any of them you approve of?
No. Short answer, no. Long answer, I think you're, that the difference you're pointing out with Mark Zuckerberg is that I don't think Mark is like really a believer in AGI or superintelligence. Like, I think what's happened with Meta is that they're behind on what is now the big prestige project. And I think, I don't know if he believed Jan LeCun, because Jan LeCun has been saying, you know, like, there's, oh, there's only so far that LLMs can go. And, you know,
We should say, so Jan LeCun is his chief AI scientist, although he seems to have kind of been pushed on the margins now.
He's pretty marginalized,
But he's a big name in AI, although not LLMs, but he is a big name in deep learning and neural networks. So go ahead.
Yeah, so he did have a genuine credential, and he's one of the, so, you know, the other big names you might hear in this field, or the biggest ones would be Jeffrey Hinton and Yashua Bengio. And the three of them, Jeffrey Hinton, Yashua Bengio, and Jan LeCun, all won the Turing Award together, which is the highest prize in computer science. So it's like the Nobel Prize of computer science. And although Jeffrey Hinton won the Nobel Prize, but they put it every, it was in physics, I think, because there's not a category for computer science and the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, some of the work he had done was relevant methodologically to the math of physics or something. I didn't quite get it. But anyway, congratulations.
Demis Hassabis
also won a Nobel, right?
They pretty much shoehorn other sciences into physics. But But, you know, the highest award that anybody would expect you to win in computer science, they had all won together. Jeffrey Hinton and Yashua Bengio are on the side of warning about risk and danger.
Right.
And but Jan LeCun just was he's stuck to his guns. He's, a lot of things he said wouldn't happen or LLMs wouldn't be able to do are just like flatly contradicted by their, you know, just in within a year, you know, of him saying it, like back 2022, 2023 have been contradicted. But he's pretty stubborn, and he was, I don't know what he was actually doing at Meta for a long time. I think that he, as far as like actually leading science projects, like, I don't know how long he's been out of that game. I think it's, you know, longer than like the last year, but he was kind of representing their stance on it, and it seemed like maybe like they had been accepting his advice, or maybe Zuckerberg listened to him. They were proud of having him, it seems like Zuckerberg has switched course, but I just kind of wonder if Zuckerberg, like, still, because there were a lot of people in tech and even people working on building LLMs who didn't really believe that there was going to be this level of, you know, back then we were talking about AGI, artificial general intelligence, being like this level kind of where a lot was unlocked because suddenly intelligence becomes not like fragmented across a bunch of domains, but it becomes general and you gain new abilities. Now people kind of see that as a much smoother progression, and AGI was kind of benchmarked at human intelligence. I think now it's increasingly clear that we're not like a special place on that. We're just kind of a place, maybe limited by the size of, you know, the pelvis, you know, there's just kind of a sliding scale of general intelligence going up and up. Now people are openly talking more about superintelligence. I don't know if Zuckerberg has ever really like had like felt the AGI, which is like what Ilya Sutskever would say at OpenAI, to like get people to understand like you really are building this project that doesn't just get a little bit better and a little bit better like you're used to with machine learning. It will become like a human mind and greater. And I don't know that, I still don't, even though we have all seen what LLMs can do, I still don't know that Zuckerberg like really has that in mind. Like, he is definitely talking the talk of that now, but in his case I kind of suspect he's just trying to keep up, like that's what other labs are doing.
My theory is it's a couple of things. He can see the way chatbots work with him sustaining and growing the platforms he's got, and he can see that he's got platforms that could give momentum to a given chatbot if that was your chatbot, and so that works in synergy. I also think he hasn't let go of the idea of the metaverse. And I think that may account for why Jan LeCun was this guy. You know, Jan LeCun did these vision, the vision processing type stuff, did more visual kinds of AI. So, but I actually still think that Zuckerberg wants to draw us into the metaverse. That's my theory. But I agree that it's a very different, all four of the other ones are very conversant in this particular kind of cultural intellectual milieu which you're in, and which you know, it goes back to kind of the rationalist community and Eliezer Yudkowsky's blog and the whole discussion about you know, superintelligence and so on, and you know, Nick Bostrom's book Superintelligence, right? I mean, these are all, do you think I'm right? I mean, they're all, four are kind of from that world, or at least have had extensive contact with it. And it's funny, the extent to which that world has shaped the discourse, right? Yeah. A relatively small community started talking about this thing 15, 20 years ago that nobody else was paying any attention to. And a lot of their terminology has survived, and their frames of reference. And I gather that that's kind of the way you entered this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's definitely, I entered it very philosophically. Mm-hmm. I didn't work on AI safety until the release of ChatGPT was like a very big, you know, I experienced that at a gut level, but it was because I had like 10 years of philosophical, like priming, like bricklaying, when I saw like a real natural language chatbot, like I thought, like, mm-hmm. I didn't think that was supposed to happen. And it was my understanding that if we did have that ability, and especially if it was happening by a process which could scale arbitrarily, that would be very dangerous. So I was ready. I switched into really working on this in 2023, after ChatGPT was released. But yeah, like the world before that was totally philosophical. It was totally reading groups at the most, you know, internet forums, like reading Superintelligence. And it was I still think for most people, the point of it was to be more of like a niche community filter than really to like worry about Superintelligence. But I think, you know, Eliezer, genuine concern always. And even as recently as 2023, like Sam Altman's Twitter bio was Eliezer Yudkowsky fan account. Like he sold OpenAI as completely responsive to Eliezer's safety concerns.
Wait, this was whose Twitter account?
Yes.
Yeah. Wait, who's Altman's or?
Altman's.
Wow, I didn't know that. So you think he was sincere at that point? I've always wondered.
I don't
wondered.
Think he was sincere, but he was definitely using it like that. He was claiming that lineage and that kind of concern.
And was that to draw Elon Musk's money into his venture? I mean, I've always wondered about.
Because I think Altman likes the idea of being, you know, a benefactor to humanity. Like that's an image that he likes for himself. But I think lately he's been happy to kind of be a villain too. Like I think probably what he really cares about is glory. And he thought there was a lot of potential for glory there. Nobody knew. I mean, OpenAI in some ways got extremely lucky. So Google wrote the Transformer paper. I think that was released in 2019. And they didn't really know what to do with it. And OpenAI picked it up, and they are the ones that really, you know, gave it legs. And they didn't know that was going to happen when they formed OpenAI. Like the whole, like when in 2015, like the idea was this could be like a moonshot technology that could be really cool. Also, there was this base of people who were willing to work for much less than market rate, you know, for their skills to work on this kind of charitable project. There was the potential for cool spinoffs and stuff. I think, you know, I think he probably just saw it as like a great R&D opportunity. And it was structured as a nonprofit, you know, all of that it was scaling up. There were existing like AI safety efforts. Like there were things like the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, which did game theory type research, which is called like Agent Foundation. So like the kind of research they were doing is like solving decision theory. Like, what would you do? What would a smarter agent do? Like, what are the equilibrium, you know, Nash equilibrium type answers for how we would interact with something smarter? And that was how they were going to feel, you know, good about going ahead with superintelligence. They also had a secret plan to make superintelligence, but it wasn't like that secret, but like that was their intent was. So we could get sidetracked on what the deal with Miri, but that was Eliezer's organization. And they didn't, it became clear that like that approach was not going to, they had given up. Now, do I think that, you know, having more than 17 guys on it for like 20 years is probably a good idea? Like, yeah, like they were pretty quick to say, if we can't do it, then nobody can. But there was an openness in AI safety at that time to more empirical approaches. Like people were kind of hungry for that. And so OpenAI was like, oh, well, as a nonprofit, like we'll be a corporation, like a real corporation, and we'll attract real investment and we'll be able to do like big empirical work, but we'll still be a nonprofit and we'll still be guided by our mission. And we'll have all of these checks in place to make sure that investors aren't, you know, dictating what we're doing and that our mission is to benefit humanity. And I think that that seemed just like a good deal at the time. And that Altman really did like believe about himself that he was like trying to benefit humanity. There was a lot of prestige in that position. It's kind of like a young religion in SF and well, in like, you know, tech in general. And you could get a lot of moral clout for doing something for the sake of AI safety. Like it was something that allowed you to show that you really got it about technology and progress. And then you also got that it was dangerous and you were responsible. People could work on it for like, even though it wasn't like a viable product that they were working on at the time, but they could work on it for less money and that would be considered quite honorable. They were like taking a pay cut. They were working for charity. So I think that's what motivated Altman at first. And then as it became like a big, at first it was a side project. He was still working at Y Combinator and right. There were issues over time with Y Combinator that he was using Y Combinator too much as a vehicle to promote the success of OpenAI. So there's emails back and forth, you know, between the Y Combinator execs and stuff about, you know, him still, I believe he was still CEO.
He was either CEO or president, yeah. And I think Paul Graham told him he needed to make a decision.
Yeah, and so, at first it was just like, this was just a side project. I mean, in the same way that any kind of like charitable project can bring a lot of prestige and glory and like make one look really good. Like, I don't think that he thought that it was going to have, I think he did really believe in the potential of the technology. Like he did believe that if we had AGI, it would be, nothing else would matter. But I don't think he thought they were going to do it or like they were going to get close. And then when it seemed like they were getting close, like they'd hit on this process, I think he just switched into a different mode. And now it's not even that I think he wants to make money. It's I think that he needs that much investment in order to make the technology bigger. Like I think his motivation is glory. Like I think that's the main, if you're trying to model Sam Altman, like glory is the main thing.
Well, one thing Paul Graham said about him is, what was it? He's good at getting power, or he likes power, something. I mean, yeah. Paul Graham has said a number of things that are testament to his ambition. Paul Graham's the guy who started Y Combinator and elevated Altman to the level of running it. So, yeah, you know, I, at the risk of being too cynical, there are these emails, I think, between Altman and Elon Musk at the right around time of OpenAI's founding, pretty early on, saying, I think before it had a structure, saying, you know, if we make it a nonprofit, that'll have a certain kind of allure to the people we want to hire. That'll be a good talent magnet. So, I don't know.
Sam Altman is extremely smart about gathering people. Actually, one thing that Paul Graham said about him was that if you dropped him like from a helicopter onto an island of cannibals and you came back, he would be leading the cannibals and like have them, you know, like running a civilization and that you should be afraid of him. I mean, that's like that quote includes kind of the most direct like warning that Graham ever gives about Altman, to my knowledge.
I gotta say, he's a very impressive guy. I mean, he's, I don't know, he's in a lot of ways, and he is he is different from the rest. So I promise we will get back to this business of evaluating all of them. But as long as we're on the nonprofit thing, mm-hmm. so this issue that is still a live issue very much that your organization has been involved in the sense of trying to put pressure on OpenAI and give visibility to the issue. The issue is, how easy should it be for them to basically abandon the nonprofit status and the obligations that go with it? How easy should it be to do that financially? Because, so first OpenAI, they moved to this intermediate stage where the nonprofit, tax-exempt organization, OpenAI, now had a subsidiary that had investors, and that's what allowed them to get money from Microsoft. And that was critical because that was after when LLMs hit, they realized we need a ton of compute if we're going to, and so we need somebody like Microsoft. So that happened. And now the current round of investors and the valuations of these companies are unbelievable. They're now valued at like $500 billion and Anthropic's at like $180 or something, according to the latest investment.
Okay.
But anyway, latest investors. What's that?
Sorry, I hadn't heard that last one for Anthropic. But
yeah, no, the next. I mean, it sounds like it's a. I think maybe I don't know if the round is closed, but yeah. I mean, it seems like 8 months ago I was saying, "Are you sure OpenAI is worth 180?" And now, like Anthropic is worth. I don't know, but anyway. So now the latest round of investors, just a ton of money going into this company. Including from SoftBank, a lot from SoftBank.
Yeah,
they want a less nebulous for-profit status that doesn't have some of the constraints that the current subsidiary for-profit company has. And in fact, Altman, in a round of investment like 6 months ago, he made some future investment contingent on him delivering on the promise that by the end of this year, I think. They would have this fully for-profit status. And that's what you don't think should happen so easily. You're like, wait a second.
My personal opinion is it shouldn't be able to happen at all, because the whole deal that our society has with nonprofits is that they are delivering on their mission. And so when you contribute to them and their future success, and the nonprofit still owns all the intellectual property of OpenAI, you can't just turn around and make money off of that. That's called inurement, and that's against the law, and that is fraud. So, I think never. I mean, all of the intellectual property that was developed under the nonprofit, which still runs the whole, is still in charge of the whole company, by the way, all of that intellectual property is the property of the nonprofit. And the way that you deal with nonprofits closing is that you have to either spend down the money on the mission, or you have to give away the assets to another group with your same mission, or the nonprofit has to be bought out and then that money spent in that way. And how could you possibly fairly value the intellectual property owned by the OpenAI nonprofit?
But that's the thing is, I mean, I think it isn't that you just have to buy the intellectual property, you have to buy all the assets, right? If the new investors are going to say, okay, now we're a for-profit company and we own it, they have to have fully compensated a nonprofit for all the assets. And what OpenAI is saying with this latest round of investment, we're worth $500 billion. I think what they're saying is our assets are worth $500 billion. Well, these guys can't give them $500 billion. I mean, I'm sure it's more complicated.
All the future earnings, which, I think various OpenAI people would say they're the seeds here to own the entire light cone, of our universe that we're in. And how can you possibly fairly compensate that? And it's in this case, I do feel like standing on ceremony, because the whole point of making it a nonprofit and the reason that, I mean, you had investors like Open Philanthropy, Dustin Moskovitz, actually. I forget all of the different investments that were made. Dustin Moskovitz made a very large donation, I think, to Anthropic in his name. And then I think the large donation, the $700 million given to OpenAI was by Open Phil. Do check that out if you're curious about the difference between those two. But basically that kind of person, you know, Dustin Moskovitz being the person whose money, you know, it makes OpenPhil. They were motivated by the charitable mission of OpenAI, and they would not have donated if it was a for-profit company, or if they thought in just, I mean, how many years, like 6 years, they would turn around and make money on that. I mean, it's just fraud. It's fraud to have put, and not to mention all the talent. I think Sam Altman is very, very charismatic, very good at wrangling talent, and he knows what's going to appeal to them, and he knows what gives. There were a lot of, like, you know, altruistically minded, high ideal, like, nerds who had the ability and who really wanted an excuse to work on AI. And I think Altman sensed this. They really, AI was really cool, but they also believed that it was like, oh, it was like not good. There would be all these problems with AI. And he gave them a way to work on AI that, like, they believed, you know, was part of a mission to actually protect the world. And that was extremely powerful. And he would not have been able to, I mean, maybe he could have convinced them at the for-profit, but I don't think so. I think, like, he knew how to, like, get his foot in the door. And the nonprofit and the nonprofit mission reassured all of the early employees of OpenAI that they were doing the right thing. And, like, you can't go back in time and just give, like, a payout now to make up for the value of that in making, in creating this technology. The whole reason that the initial donors and investors and talent got together was because of the nonprofit mission and because it was a nonprofit. So there's just no fair way, in my opinion, to restructure. I mean, perhaps there are ways that certain projects could be, like, spun out. I don't feel completely unreasonable on it, but just the intellectual property of the nonprofit has to remain substantially the nonprofit's. And, like, in order to really compensate the value of that intellectual property, like, very small spun off projects would take, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to really compensate the nonprofit that value, or huge stakes in the profits of for-profit ventures. Like, it would, to truly do that fairly, I think is impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I should add, after having pronounced on this matter, that I don't know what I'm talking about. Now, what is true is that in principle, at least, if you're going to take a nonprofit and turn it into a for-profit, the nonprofit is supposed to be compensated for the full value of the assets. I'm pretty sure of that. But there's all kinds of wrinkles in the case of OpenAI. And the other thing is, I mean, the where they're running into most of the resistance right now is the California State Attorney General. And what I'm talking about is the federal law, as I understand it. But and it may be that once they started this subsidiary, all these wrinkles entered it that I don't understand. But anyway,
but they're not talking about taking the profit capped entity there. What they're talking about is taking the profit capped entity and turning it into a benefit corporation, but then reducing the control of the nonprofit over that. And that's the part that's not, I mean, I don't know,
Changing
their subsidiary into a for-profit, like, maybe, but they want to take the power of the nonprofit away from managing it. Like, and the power that they would give it is to appoint board members, but not for its board to run the.
Wait, the power, who would get to appoint board members?
The most recent proposed plan. So at first they wanted to just become a for-profit entity that faced a lot of pushback. Their current proposal is to take the profit capped entity that currently exists, which is OpenAI Global LLC, and turn that into a public benefit corporation. And then, but, like, which, you know, maybe they can do that because already that's set up as a for-profit entity, but it's got this structure where it's under the it's run by the nonprofit under its control, and it has a profit cap. The profit cap has gone, like, up and down, but at first it was like 100x and it was supposed to go down every year, then it actually started going up by 20%. But that's already set up as a for-profit. It just has this funky, like, capping mechanism. So turning that into a benefit corp, maybe, like, but changing the control of that benefit corp from the nonprofit, that's just disturbing the nonprofit.
Yeah. I mean, as you said, right now there is a 100 times cap on, so, like, Microsoft, You know, it has an amount that it's invested in OpenAI, and there's a ceiling of 100 times that investment that it can ultimately
reap.
Well, that's
what it was in 2019. So in 2019, it was 100x and it was supposed to go down. And then I think sometime before 2023, Sam Altman bragged that the cap was in the single digits.
Oh, really?
Because they were supposed to reduce it every year.
Huh, but I didn't know that.
But then they didn't admit this, but I think just the economists broke that actually it had changed so that it was increasing 20%. The cap was increasing 20% every year. And at that rate, it only takes 40 years to be the size of the world's economy or something. So like, yeah. It's a lot. It's like seven times, you know, economic growth. So, I mean, the point was to just increase profits and I guess in a way that they felt was justifiable. They never explained their reasoning on that it was just like reported that the structure had changed. So I don't know where Microsoft's profits were at the time that now, you know, in 2025, they are in, at the end of 2024, I guess they were talking about just turning it all into a for-profit corporation. Mm-hmm. And apparently had like made promises to investors like this. And then now their proposal is Benefit Corp. Like there, it seemed like there were successful. I always felt like, there's more than one way to ruin this. Like, I really think the only like morally acceptable outcome.
Any way is fine with you as long as it gets ruined, right?
Sorry?
I said any way is fine with you as long as it gets ruined. Or no, that's not what you meant.
I want them to stay a nonprofit. I mean, I prefer that they close, you know, but I don't think there's any fair way. Like a benefit corp also does not prioritize the charitable mission. It puts it allows you to have a charitable mission as well as shareholder benefits, but no shareholder has ever sued successfully to say that a public benefit corporation is not fulfilling the charitable mission. Like it would be a loss of the charitable mission controlling. And
yeah, I think Anthropic is a public benefit corporation,
is, yeah.
Right? And the only real difference is that they are not accountable to stockholders. A regular corporation is kind of committed to, I think, maximizing shareholder value or something. And a public benefit corporation has at least the option of taking other considerations into account, saying, no, that yes, it would maximize profits, but it wouldn't be good for the world. It's really not much of a constraint at all. Whereas a nonprofit structure is a constraint, and that's what they would like to do without. Okay,
even if OpenAI was like not a bad company and I didn't really care about them turning into a for-profit, it's too fraudulent. They are what they are today because they started as a nonprofit. They can't be allowed to shake that.
Well, and we should say that Elon Musk, who contributed most of the money to it, is of course not happy about this.
No.
he's one of the people who's been raising a ruckus. And meanwhile, I learned in the course of a kind of a DM with you that OpenAI is now what's this group? So this group, the Midas Project, OpenAI is now claiming that Elon Musk is behind that, or did
they subpoenaed them to like produce any conversations or documents with Musk, like to investigate whether he's behind it, which is ridiculous. I can tell you for a fact, the Midas Project is one guy. He's the treasurer of Pause AI US, Tyler Johnston. OpenAI Files, which is probably why they were subpoenaed, is a project with tech oversight. The tiniest of nonprofits they're going after, you know, as if it takes Elon Musk's money to look up these public documents. It takes dedicated people who are trying to protect the world to look up these documents. And really, that's all. Like, I think it was really great reporting that they did. But if we had more reporters, you know, just at news papers with the... It's so unfortunate. There's just like, they're lacking like certain know-how and like certain knowing certain things to look for. And Tyler has that know-how, and he developed sort of the journalistic ability to do it. And tech oversight, I know less about, but I think they just, they developed this project out of necessity. But I think we could be having amazing finds like this by all kinds of people if they kind of knew what to look for and they knew enough of like the story around OpenAI. And just, but with that, you know, they were able to uncover a lot of, put together a lot of publicly available documents that really like make the case about the restructuring being illegitimate. But this was something that was known by people who were around when OpenAI was founded and watching what was going on. I mean, the story they were telling then is much different than the story that they're telling now. But the idea that Elon Musk has to be behind that is so like, they just want it out there that, I mean, this is my conjecture. OpenAI wants it out there that like, oh, if you hear something bad about OpenAI, it's probably slander from Elon Musk. And they want to intimidate these, I believe, you know, they want to intimidate these nonprofits.
Yeah. The so anyway, people should stay tuned on this story. According to the Wall Street Journal, OpenAI kind of halfway denies this, but the journal says OpenAI is even thinking about leaving California because it's the California Attorney General who's putting the pressure on. You're shaking your head. And there was
California.
Also skepticism in the Wall Street Journal story about them leaving
California. I appreciated that they, because often this is reported kind of uncritically, like, oh, they're saying they might leave. And then everybody's kind of like, oh God, we're going to lose our golden goose, you know, but like, they can't leave. Also, they are a nonprofit, and California, all those like nonprofit parts of the company take place in California. And where if you move to another state as a nonprofit, you're still under the laws of the state. Sorry, not exactly sure if that's the reason, but I do know in the case of OpenAI, like their nonprofit is like totally under the jurisdiction of California, and it's not going to change if they just like move offices. So like that's, especially if they're under investigation, that they can't just apply to change to being, you know, incorporated somewhere else, like as a nonprofit. Like the rules, they take advantage of this a lot, that people don't know the difference between nonprofit governance and for-profit governance. So people they'll say things, you know, that like people who have knowledge of for-profit companies or for-profit boards or something, like back, you know, in 2023 with when the board fired Sam Altman, people will think like, what? Like, but the shareholders, that's terrible. Like, you can't do that. And like, they think they know the rules, but the rules for nonprofits are different. For nonprofit boards, the board has the right to fire the executive director. Like, that's it. And that was the law. By the way, that's what should have been upheld as the law with the board. But, you know, just because people were too confused and there were a lot of powerful, you know, people who consider themselves shareholders, but who weren't actually, because it's a nonprofit run by a mission, made that not happen. But they do this a lot, where they like throw stuff like this out, you know, and they want like public pressure, people to be scared. For some reason, I meet a lot of these people who are kind of like fanboys of the organization. Like, not, they don't really have anything to particularly like profit, you know, from OpenAI. Maybe they're bots, I don't know. But like, people, you know, bring online, like try to talk to me, where they say like, well, California is going to lose OpenAI. Like, that's going to be this big indictment on us. And they want to whip that up, even though there is no way. A lot of people when SB 1047, which was a bill, you know, in last year's session in California, people were saying like, oh, our company is going to have to like leave California. I never heard a threat that anybody could actually go through with that would make any sense. Like, their employees live in California. That's one thing. They're to actually like move all of their operations to some other state to spite California and like take away the economic benefits would be prohibitive for them. Also, in this case, it's just not possible. Like, they can't get away from the California Attorney General by moving somewhere else, because they're a nonprofit incorporated in California and they're under investigation. And like, you can't just change venue because you're annoyed. Like, that's part of the whole nonprofit status that they're trying to get away from.
So I promised that we'd get back to your thumbnail evaluations. Last thing I'd quickly say on this issue before that is just that it's funny that Altman, you know, wants to get a complete divorce from the governing structure of the nonprofit, because in the course of his getting briefly fired, which you alluded to, in the aftermath of that, he managed to install a very Sam-friendly board at the top of the nonprofit. So it's not like they're making his life miserable. But anyway, his investors would like all of the constraints removed. So I guess that explains
it. I think the cap is the main motivating.
What's that? Yeah, the cap, the profit cap.
But I think he also wants to be free. I do get the sense there's like a little bit of, even though it's new people in the board, like he's kind of like, never again, like I'm not entrusting, you know, my power to anyone else.
Mm. Yeah, that could be. It was a harrowing experience for him. So
he should have just been fired.
Yeah.
I take every opportunity to criticize Emmett Shear, the interim CEO, which a lot of people saw as like so reasonable at the time. Like Eliezer like wrote about him in the most, like, I mean, talk about glazing, the word that Sam Altman made popular. Like it just, he.
But glazing meaning like flattering, right? Yes. Like a sycophantic AI glazes you.
Yeah. So even like Eliezer Yudkowsky did this about Emmett Shear, but like what he should have done was follow the law, which is have the board's decision follow through. I mean, it was like wild. Everybody at the top, like, just didn't have the heart to, like, either they didn't know, like they were, and like, or they were like ideologically like, no, but OpenAI, they still at that time in 2023, like felt like, oh, but OpenAI like might actually be good. And like, you know, we need to like have the good one, like leading the pack. And like, and they just broke the law. They just completely overrode what the board said. The law is that the nonprofit board was supposed to be in charge of that decision, and they just didn't get any support from anybody who was supposed to back them up in the company. And then Emmett Shear completely fell down and was like basically like trying to put
Sam
back.
I mean, I don't want to get too deeply into the weeds, but Mira Murati, I thought, could have stepped up a little more. Did you read the account in Karen Howe's book, Empire of AI?
I haven't read it.
Oh, it's really good. Very deeply reported. The account of the board coup is definitely worth reading.
It's to call it a coup, even. Like, that meme got out there. It's not a coup. They were in charge.
No, they had the power to fire the guy. It's the board.
There would be an accountability to shareholders if it were a for-profit board, but it wasn't.
Yeah. And there's a great quote from Helen Toner, who was on the board at the time. And I think somebody said at some point, by way of trying to condemn the board's decision, what the board was doing, that this could lead to the destruction of OpenAI. And she said something like, well, that could be consistent with our mandate. In other words, and she's right. I mean, the nonprofit board's job is basically to make sure that either the organization serves the mandate under which it is a nonprofit or doesn't exist. Both of those things are compatible with its mission. But and that was kind of her line. Anyway, I recommend that book. So anyway, back to the evaluations. How about we put it this way? Of the big five, is there one that you would trust more than the other four, or a couple you would trust more than the other three? To be conscientious about the social impact of AI and about even the possibly existential threat that AI takeover could pose and so on.
I'm reluctant to give anybody, like, even if it's like logically indicated, like most trusted, you know. I will say, okay, I do, like, I believed Dario the most, that he like knows and cares about the safety, but I also find him kind of the most insidious for this reason. Like, I think that the most snake in the grass of all is Sam Altman. But Dario bothers me because I think like he gives himself a pass. He thinks he's pretty great. Like, he thinks he's really taking the world's interests into account. And then he just, as soon as he's confronted with like, oh, but we're not going to be competitive if we don't, you know, get investment from the Middle East, like suddenly, oh, we got to do it. He just gives himself a pass for anything that anybody else. Yeah,
that was a famous pivot he did. He recently said, okay, it looks like, you know, I have said, because his whole thing is like AI has to be put to anti-authoritarian purposes. We don't want to get in bed with autocrats. But then he, by his own admission, he just, in a concession to reality, given how much money it takes to sustain these companies, he said he will be accepting money from authoritarian.
He really, so that bugs me the most because he uses like a morality that matters a lot to me. So like my background is in effective altruism and like that's, I believe Dario and I are still Facebook friends, like, because like from back then, like that meant a lot to me, like that kind of thinking. And he uses like counterfactual reasoning about, well, what would have happened anyway, which like used to be listed as, I don't know, in various like EA curricula. That was like one of the top five like reasoning tools you need for effective altruism was counterfactual reasoning. So it's not just like, is this a good thing? But it's like, is it better than the alternatives? Like that when you're deciding what to do. He just took a big population of people who like had that kind of thinking installed in them. And he like pattern matched, he like used, oh, well, we have to because other companies are going to do, well, if we don't do this, then somebody else is going to do it. And we're slightly better. So like, that's okay. And like, I think he knows better. I think he knows what's happening. He just thinks that if he were in control of the AI, like that would be, he would do it right, you know? And like, so I think he's really the same, like in the end, as someone like Sam Altman, who he just thinks he's like doing it on behalf of everyone else. And he has this like moral justification in his head. And so I don't really want to say like, even though like I see that he's like sensitive and I see that Anthropic, like, take some precautions, and like part of me wants to acknowledge that, but another part of me thinks like, no, this is for them, this is moral licensing. They just think that that because nobody else is doing better, like they should just what, like be in this race, make it more intense, like get like advance, you know, timelines by, they all think that that's the effect of more people being in the race. But you know, just sometimes counterfactual reasoning matters and sometimes it doesn't. You know, they'll be like, well, we have to do it. You know, it doesn't matter. Like, well, it's just unfortunate that there are these side effects. Sometimes, you know, they have to, other people have to stop doing stuff because of the side effects. It just, like, they really bastardize that way of thinking, which is supposed to be like a higher level moral consideration. And so I feel the most frustrated at Anthropic because they're the ones who, they seem the most to like share my concerns, but they just allow themselves to do, to like directly contribute to bad stuff. And kind of the justification is actually they'll deny that this is what the name means, but the name Anthropic is for Anthropic problems. There is no way they did not know.
So I took it to mean for humankind's benefit.
Well, so it has that meaning. But there is no way that this name was not chosen being aware of Anthropic problems, the class of philosophical problems. People talk about Anthropic problems.
Like the Anthropic principle?
Yeah. So yeah. So Anthropic problems are ones like the Anthropic principle. It's like when it matters who the person is in the dilemma. And I think what it means is we are the good guys. They also say this frequently. I mean, the employees tell me just dead ass, like we're the good guys all the time. Like they believe that about themselves and they say that openly about themselves. So it's the idea that they are the ones who need to control superintelligence. They are the ones who can do it. Like, and that's, no one has admitted to me from the company that that's what the name is, but I'm telling you, like in the environment in which Anthropic arose, like Dario was very close. So Dario and like Dario's sister, Daniela, who's the president of Anthropic, I still believe, is married to Holden Karnofsky, who was for a long time the CEO of Open Philanthropy. And they all live together and they all are like a very tight intellectual group. And there is just no way in that environment, the way that people would like throw around the term Anthropics, you know, like that they did not know when they picked that name for the company leaving OpenAI and forming a new company, that that's what it would at least have that meaning.
So you're saying the name is kind of a way of saying I'm special?
I think so. Yeah, like we're the good ones. So not everybody could do this, but
I gotta say, one does sometimes get that vibe when he's talking about his mission. But look, don't we all think we're special? I think I'm special. So listen,
qualified, like as far as like morality and as far as like appreciating the danger and like seeming to have the sensitivity and sophistication to do that, like I would give that to Dario. But I also consider Dario like more insidious in some ways because he has that ability.
Okay, so as you know, Holly, from your last visit, most of the conversation happens in public, and now nearly an hour of it has. But then some of it happens in what we call overtime, which is available to paid subscribers, the Non-Zero newsletter, which we encourage everyone to become. Link in the show notes or go to the Non-Zero Substack and so on. So we're going to go into overtime. And among the enticements is that I'm going to make a case for one of the five being.
Oh, really?
The one I'd put my, if I had to put the future planet Earth in the hands of one of them, for me, the choice is reasonably clear. But anyway, and I'll maybe press you for more evaluation. But first, I'm going to give you a chance to tell people like where they can find your stuff and how to or how to get involved in the cause or whatever you want to say.
So yes, our organization is Pause AI US, and you can find us at Pause PAUSE AI-US.org. That's our website. And you should find links to everything else from there. You can also find us on social media. If you search Pause AI US, you may find the other Pause AIs. If you're listening from another country, you'll want to find your country if you're there. And if not, there's a big global Discord for everybody to kind of get coordinated. And maybe if you're interested in starting a branch, you can do that.
All right. Also, you and I are apparently going to be an online book party for Eliezer Yudkowsky's forthcoming book. If anybody builds it, everybody dies.
If anyone builds it, everyone dies. And actually, yeah. Pause AI is doing a series of book clubs for a little bit after the launch in October. So the one in San Francisco is on October 4th, and it's going to be at Manny's in from 5 to 8. And there's going to be one October 12th, I believe, in NYC. Those are our bookend events. And then there are lots of smaller events throughout the country in between.
Mm-hmm. And then the thing you and I are both going to be on, I think not together, but both of us at one time or another, is this some kind of live stream thing done by Liron Shapira on his podcast, Doom Debates. And that'll be, I think, next week. Well, I don't know when this is going to air, but I think it's going to air this week.
That's going to be on Tuesday, which is the launch.
Yeah, so that's Tuesday. The date of that is
the 16th.
The 20th is Monday, so it must be 21st September. Okay, so thanks everybody for following us this far. If you're not going to follow us into overtime, but we would rather you did.